وصل على محمد وآل محمد. فمن يكون أسوأ حالا مني إن أنا نقلت على مثل حالي إلى قبر لم أمهده لرقدتي ولم أفرشه بالعمل الصالح لضجعتي.
Brothers and sisters, we were talking about this part. فَمَنْ يَكُونُ أَسْوَأَ حَالًا مِّنِّي إِنْ أَنَا نُقِلْتُ عَلَى مِثْلِ هَالِي إِلَى قَبْرِي. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says, if you send me to the grave while I am in this state, is there anyone who could be in a worse state? So, Imam alayhi salam has this kind of ma'rifah and is actually telling us, teaching us how we should supplicate. Unless man realizes his meanness, he cannot savor the taste of God's forgiveness, because the more he becomes heedful of his sins and meanness, God's forgiveness becomes more pleasant to him, and he realizes his mercy more profoundly. And that's why God wants his servants to confess to their sins. In some supplications, there are various expressions and wordings that make man reach a station that makes him deserve divine mercy. For example, it is said in one supplication, O God, how will you punish this servant of yours, on whom you bestowed all these blessings? You provided everything he needed. You nurtured him with your diverse blessings. While he was committing sins, you gave him the glad tidings of forgiveness. You gave him the tidings of pardon and compassion, and you invited him to repent and feel sorrow and be hopeful of your grace and mercy. You invited him and instilled your love in his heart so that he would hasten to worship you. He expected your mercy and cried in fear of your wrath. This is actually what is causing the state of balance between khawf and raja, being hopeful and being fearful.
شهر رمضان الذي أنزل فيه القرآن هدى للناس وبينات من الهدى والفرقان فمن شهد
The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it. And whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which He has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
Anyway, since we were talking about the confession of the sins in our supplication, we concluded that these supplications and confessings make man's heart heedful of God and instill in him the faculty of comprehending the divine mercy. If you do not consider your sins and your sinful acts, how can you understand and recognize the vastness of mercy of the Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? And this is actually the only way that you can comprehend the divine mercy. So these supplications, these confessings, they stimulate God's mercy. Therefore, it is indeed commendable for man to recall his sins and be heedful of God's infinite mercy. By doing so, we will realize that how many sins we have committed and we have went against God's order, and we have had so many great sins that commission of any of which is enough for one to deserve years of punishment. Yet God has disregarded all of them, and he has extended his mercy upon the servants. So the more man realizes his poverty and helplessness vis-a-vis God, he becomes more humble and he deserves the divine grace or favor. Ilahi atawassalu ilayka bifaqri ilayk. O Allah, I seek your help through my poverty in relation to you. So when Imam says, فَمَنْ يَكُونُ أَسْوَأَ حَالًا مِّنِّي إِنْ أَنَا نُقِلْتُ عَلَىٰ مِثْلِهَا لِي إِلَىٰ قَبْرِي. If you send me to the grave while I am still in this state, is there anyone who could be in a worse state? He is in the total state of servitude, confessing to his sins, knowingly asking the Almighty Allah not to admit him to hellfire. It is that the holy Imam is taking shelter with Allah during prayer like a distressed person who finds none other than Allah to rely upon and place his hope in. If a supplicant's hope is divided between Allah and other than him of his creatures, he has not attained due absorption in Almighty Allah. And you may remember that we previously mentioned this state is one of the fundamental requisites for the acceptance of prayer, and this is what we are taught throughout the supplication, specifically this part of the supplication of Abu Hamza. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Now, the 200th death anniversary of French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte has brought a unique opportunity for private collectors to buy his DNA. The auction offers Napoleon's blood-stained cloth, which is estimated to be sold for $18,000. The collection will also include a lock of the French Emperor's hair, a pair of his stockings, a shirt with an embroidered letter N, and other items of clothing.
Léon, c'était, à mon avis, le... In my opinion, Napoleon was the first to want to create a Napoleon brand, even when he was alive. He created an image, a symbol, a look, with his hat worn in reverse. It was a very ordinary hat, an ordinary coat, but he was a very good communicator, and he created his image. So generation after generation, we kept this image of Napoleon, his hat, and this contributed to the myth. But it was Napoleon who wanted, from the beginning, to create an image, a look.
Nearly 360 objects will go under the hammer in the upcoming auction. Many of the items are brought back from Napoleon's last residence on St. Helena Island. Historians say his belongings have sparked the passion of collectors in France and other parts of the world. Several years ago, one of the French emperor's signature Baikon hats was sold to a Korean food industry mogul for more than $2 million. A Belgian chocolate maker has come up with the idea of chocolate bunnies in the shape of vaccine syringes to spread hope during the coronavirus pandemic. Geneviève Trapon makes the chocolate bunnies at her workshop in a village south of Brussels. She has dubbed the chocolate syringes Lache à Aztec. I hope I pronounced that correctly. This is not the first time the Belgian confectioner has been inspired by the pandemic to create art. Last year, she also put white masks on its Easter bunnies to keep the spirit alive amid a worsening pandemic. Trapon says she came up with the idea of syringe-shaped bunnies after the first coronavirus inoculations in her country at the end of 2020.
Why did I decide to create the chocolate vaccine? We are still in a period of COVID-19, and it was the logical continuation of the little masked rabbit from last year. Back then, nobody was talking about vaccines. At the end of that year, we started talking about a vaccine, and I thought the rabbit should be vaccinated. It's a symbol of hope, and that's why I decided to create the vaccine.
Trapon says her works show natural health benefits of chocolate. She believes that the chocolate version, like a real vaccine, has enough positive effects such as anti-depression, nutrients, and magnesium. Many of us have missed air traveling, though, due to the coronavirus pandemic. Now, a South Korean airline has opened a restaurant offering in-flight meals on land. The Jeju Air restaurant resembles being in a flight with mock plane windows and boarding gates. It serves popular onboard meals such as rice and chicken. Customers have hailed the creative idea, saying the experience reminds them of the joy of travel. Having food in the imaginary flight costs around $9 for each person. The temporary diner will run for the next 3 months. Let's go to the Philippines to meet a man having a big, colorful collection of Happy Meal toys. Percival Log has been into collecting toys since he was five. His collection includes around 20,000 toys from fast food restaurant chains like McDonald's and Burger King. Log also holds a Guinness World Record from 2014. The 50-year-old graphic artist says he always takes good care of his beloved toys. He believes each toy has a story inside.
Toy is like a storyteller in itself. Like, for example, it gives me a glimpse of that particular period when I got it, my story, what's going on, what are the incidents that are attached in the acquisition of that particular toy.
Luke says his family and friends also help him broaden his collection by donating toys. He hopes to display his toy collection for the public to, quote, give people a chance to revisit their childhood memories.
People around the world have been grounded by the coronavirus, with many being forced to work from home. But the Scottish man has made his secluded cliffside a perfect spot against the pandemic-induced change to working habits. Jason Griffith Griffins, a 34-year-old call center consultant from Glasgow, has put remote working technology to the test by moving his office to a dangling shelf off the Irish Sea. His move is seen as an attempt to give rise to the digital nomad, meaning people can use technology to work from wherever connectivity is possible. Griffin says as long as there is a mobile connection and his laptop, he has everything he needs to do his job.
Today we are pushing the technology to its limits because we're going over cliff face, we're abseiling down to a ledge, and I will be working all day from that ledge and taking and making calls, interacting with internal staff, just showing that remote literally means remote.
Griffins has set up a temporary office on a cliff face to prove that its performance is as good as a busy office. Call centers are one sector where remote working and technology has kept companies connected to customers. But the digital revolution has seen an inclination towards working remotely. The pink supermoon has glowed over different landmarks all over the world. The phenomenon lit up the sky in different countries from Greece to China on Tuesday night. The supermoon occurs when a full moon is closer to Earth than usual and therefore appears bigger and brighter in the sky. The term was first coined by an American astrologer in 1979. When the supermoon rises in April, it's called the pink supermoon after a pink wildflower that blooms in the eastern parts of North America. According to NASA, the next supermoon will come in less than a month on May 26th.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Large chocolate reproduction of Picasso's iconic painting of Guernica has gone on display in the Basque country town. A steady stream of residents has visited the artistic work created by 40 Basque chocolatiers. The work of art is expected to stay in Guernica until it tours different Spanish and European cities. The move marks the 84th anniversary of the bombing of Guernica in northern Spain by Nazi Germany. Picasso painted Guernica to portray the suffering of people and animals wrought by violence and chaos. Upon completion, Guernica was put on display at a Paris exposition in 1937. Lebanon has unveiled its first indigenously produced electric car, which is also the first ever car manufactured in the country. The red sports car Quds Rise is named after the Palestinian holy city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, which remains under Israel's occupation. The car is adorned at the front with a golden logo of the Dome of the Rock, signifying the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. It's the project of Lebanese-born Palestinian businessman Jihad Mohammed.
We have two sources of electricity. There is the state's electricity that are the generators, so we pay to 10 recharging stations, and we are looking for secure places to install them.
The company hopes to start the production of up to 10,000 units of his electric sports car in Lebanon later this year. Jihad Mohammed says his long-term goal is to compete on international markets for hybrid and electric cars, as well as to make sales in Lebanon. In a remote part of Pakistan, two sisters have come up with a unique idea to help children continue their education during pandemic-related school closures: a camel library. The mobile library visits four villages in Pakistan's largest province of Balochistan. Children borrow books and return them the next time the camel visits. The project was founded by a local high school principal and his sister. Rahima Jalal says she started the project because she wanted children around her remote hometown to continue learning despite schools being closed.
When the coronavirus spread, the entire region and all the schools were closed. There was an atmosphere of depression for old and young alike. The region where I live, there is no entertainment for children at all, no place for outings. The only activity is the children going to school and coming back home. After the schools had remained closed for 8 or 9 months due to COVID, we started wondering what we could do for the children. How could we start some sort of activity which would keep children busy and also be of some benefit to them?
Pakistan closed its schools early in 2020 due to the coronavirus pandemic and sent some 50 million school and university students home. The closures put children in Balochistan at particular risk of falling behind, as the province is Pakistan's most impoverished. Even though some schools have reopened, children in this region still have trouble accessing educational resources. NASA's Ingenuity Mars helicopter has successfully completed its third flight on the Red Planet while moving farther and faster than ever before. It was nothing short of amazing, says the Ingenuity Project's program executive. The drone covered 50 meters of distance, reaching the speed of nearly 2 meters per second. In its latest flight, the helicopter filmed 80 seconds of video, which are to be sent to Earth in the coming days. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration says similar flights are yet to come, with each planned to be of increasing difficulty in order to push Ingenuity to its limits. The experiment will end in 1 month in order to let Perseverance return to its main task, searching for signs of past microbial life on Mars.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the problems and questions that parents have in regards to the Islamic upbringing of their children. To help us with our questions, we have in the studio with us our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. As always, it's very nice to have you here, Brother Miqdad. Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salaam wa rahmatullah. The pleasure is all mine.
So the question that we have today is from a parent who asks, I get into a lot of fights with my children and it always gets very noisy and comes along with a lot of shouting. How can I de-escalate at that moment, and how can I prevent our family from falling into so many harmful disputes?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As they say, prevention is always better than cure. So a couple of points on this. First and foremost, it's important to find out what are the reasons why we end up fighting, right? So parents, mom and dad together, ideally, sit down one night and make a list of those reasons that led us to fight in the past month, for example, in the past 2 months, for example. What caused it? What was the reasons why we end up fighting? And is it possible for us to solve those problems beforehand in order to avoid those fights, right? Whether they're things that related to particular things, or they're related to particular people, they're related to particular scenarios, What are those triggers that happen, and is it possible to control those triggers? And you realize that I would even go to the extent of saying that a majority of those triggers can be solved beforehand. And you'd be surprised when you make a list, you realize, oh my God, in those 10 or 12 scenarios where we had a fight, okay, 8 of them could have been prevented if I had done this an hour before or a day before, even a week before, right? And it's always better to prevent it, right? So first and foremost, I would really encourage parents to think about what led to those, what are the triggers for those fights, and try and solve it beforehand. Now, how to solve it and what to do to ensure that this doesn't happen perhaps is another discussion, but I think with all the principles that we've talked about, parents can actually know where, how to solve the problems, basically, how to solve the triggers.
And can we get our children to do the same thing as well, to ask them, hey, how about you try to find the cause as well?
That's a good idea. It depends on the child's age, obviously. It depends how old they are. It depends on how understanding they are as well. But yes, you could try it and say, last time we had a fight, or even without saying that, say, what do you think we can do to prevent avoiding any fights in the family, for example? They might come up with a list as well.
But normally then the blame game starts.
Exactly. So you want to avoid that, basically. It's mainly finding out, that's why I mentioned it depends on the age of the child and maturity of the child. We're here to solve problems, basically. We don't want to say it's your fault or my fault. It's like, okay, what was that problem, okay, that led to a conflict? Is it possible to remove the problem so we don't have any conflict? Right.
All right, I'm going to take a quick break, an early break here, so that we can have more time to discuss another question on this topic just after the break, so don't go away.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about how to prevent having fights with our children. And later on, we're going to talk about how to de-escalate at the peak of the fight. Now, just before the break, you said that a good idea is to reflect on the fights that we had, to study the cause of what led to these fights. Since the parents are the ones who are supposed to raise children, guide them, and direct them, when a parent is looking for the cause, should they be looking for what the mistakes that the child has made, or the mistakes that they have made themselves?
In many cases, it's neither. We're not talking about mistakes. We're talking about triggers, right? Those things that lead to a fight. Let's say, for example, the last time we had a fight, okay, was because the child came back home, okay, came from the garden, okay, and made the entire carpet dirty, right? And we had a big fight. Why don't you clean the carpet? Your room is always dirty. No, I really wanted to play, and it became very messy, okay? The trigger over here was carpet being dirty because child went in the garden playing, came back dirty, okay? That's a trigger for the fight, okay? What if I make the situation, what if I try and solve the problem beforehand? In a way, for example, I buy a mat, okay, at the entrance of the room, okay? And I ensure that the child has an extra pair of clothes outside in the garden, okay? I maybe perhaps arrange, for example, a tap somewhere in the garden that they can wash themselves. Or I make the play, basically find different kind of solutions where you're actually removing the trigger, okay, to have a scenario whereby we'll need to fight over this. So it wasn't about any mistakes that happened, because we're talking about younger children, right? It wasn't a mistake that happened as such. I don't want to try and say, okay, it was your mistake, let's try and correct a mistake. I'm more trying to go back even a step before that and say, let's remove the trigger completely, let's avoid the situation completely, so that we don't have to have a frustration or a particular reason to fight over.
Okay, now let's move on to the next part of the question. A parent is now at the peak of their fight, everyone's shouting over the other, and the parent suddenly realizes and wants to de-escalate. How do you recommend they do that?
Before I do that, let me just mention one more point on what we were saying before. Is that one of the things we should also do as parents is to pick our battles as well, right? In families that you have a lot of battles, a lot of disagreements and fights, as you want to call it, parents should kind of pick their fights, right? Let's say you have 12 fights over a month, okay? Then reduce them just based on the fact that this one I'm not going to fight over, right? I'm happy to let it happen, kind of thing, basically. And give priority to the more important ones. The reason is because you don't want to end up as a family that is constantly bickering and fighting, basically. Family life should be very respectful, full of love. You don't want to anger a very angry family, a very constantly fighting family, right? Now, I know it happens. We have fights, okay? We get angry moments. There's a lot of shouting that happens sometimes, okay? But make a mental note for yourself that the next time this happens, let me choose it. Really, is it worth me going into this right now or not? If I'm going to pick 4 battles this month, okay? If we're going to have 10 battles this month, let me just pick 4 of them, okay? And this particular one right now today, I'll just close my eyes and say, okay, you know what? We're not going to fight over this one. Just pick your battles. Just because you don't want this to become a routine, because it doesn't have a very nice ending. A family that is constantly fighting over everything is not a very stable and very strong family. And it brings about very bad habits later on, basically. So that's one point. Secondly is, obviously, we'll encourage parents to go through courses on controlling, on anger management, controlling their anger, learning how to control their frustration, finding out the different tips out there. And there are courses out there, Islamic courses on anger management, for example, where there's different tips that are discussed from the Ahlul Bayt about how to ensure that we are able to overcome this sense of anger within us and control and manage our anger in order to make sure that we solve a problem without the need to react in a way that will lead us to regret afterwards.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to go for a break right now so that we can have more time to talk about the next part of our question. Don't go away.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "He who has a child must treat him in a childish manner."
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about families that fight a lot, how they can prevent those fights. And now let's imagine a scenario where parents are fighting with their children. They're at the peak of the fight, at the heat of the fight, and a parent suddenly realizes and they want to de-escalate. How do you recommend they do that? Part of the issue concern might be that if they suddenly go silent, the parents suddenly go silent, the children might think that they were right and they won that battle.
I kind of want to come out of this scenario and say, why do we have to look at things from a I won or I lost the battle, right? I think parents should realize that families shouldn't work like this, where we have disputes and we have fights and then I won the battle or you won the battle. This is a very ego-like way of looking at things, right? Let's create a family whereby even when we have disagreements and we have moments where it flares up, as you call it, it shouldn't be that it's I won against you or you lost, basically. We had a moment where, okay, we weren't able to control our emotions and we screamed at each other. Let's calm down now, or after a moment when everything can calm down, let's discuss it, basically, and say, okay, what happened? What led to this? Not in a way that I was right, you were wrong, okay? Not as a blame game, but understanding the situation and understanding what ought to have been done. At that moment, at that peak, okay, the key is to try and bring it back to normal as soon as possible, right? Say, you know what, I'm done with this conversation, okay? Let's just move away from it. We'll come back and talk about it later, okay? Physical contact is very important. We had this in Hadith as well, that when you're angry with one of your family members, then have physical contact. Touch their hand, touch their shoulder, give it a hug. Difficult many a times, but even if it's just touching physical contact with skin to skin, basically, is very important. But just taking a step back and say, let's come back to when our emotions are more under control, basically. So going to our rooms, or let's just be quiet for 2 minutes, okay, and then let's discuss it more rationally. Basically bringing it down, okay, let's sit down. If you're both standing and screaming at each other, say, let's sit down for a moment, let's sit down, okay, let's put our heads back on and think about things and see what ought to have been done, basically. So at that flare of the moment, at that peak of the moment, is to really bring an end to it, okay, without needing to have a conclusion to it. We've said many times that in that peak of the moment, that peak of anger, never make a decision, never give an instruction, never make a statement that is going to be regretful later on, never accuse somebody, right? At that level of anger, you really have to control yourself. You have to bring it back down and end it as soon as you can. Basically, say, okay, let's stop right now. If we need, we'll come back to it later and we'll discuss it later when it's more possible to discuss.
At the beginning of the show, I asked a question about the blame game, and you said that it's important that we don't call it blame. It's not about finding who should take the blame. It's about the triggers. Now, what if in a scenario we find the trigger? The child has come into the hallway with muddy shoes and refuses to take off their shoes. But they won't accept this, that this was a trigger and this was a mistake to make. Because I'm talking about a scenario when we're in dialogue with our children. That, look, we had a fight. This was the reason why we had a fight. You came in, I asked you to do not. I had asked you before not to do that. You knew perfectly well why you shouldn't do it. And yet, you came in with muddy shoes. They fail to accept that they were to blame, even if we call it a trigger. It's a complicated question, and I'm not quite sure if you can answer it in a minute or not, but if you could give at least a short introduction, an idea, basically.
If it's a four-year-old around that age, okay, four-year-olds are not able to overcome what they like through reasoning, okay? So you do not expect from a child, a four-year-old, to be able to listen to this kind of instruction, okay? And you can't be like, but I had told you, why you're not listening. The child inside him saying that, I knew I wasn't supposed to do it, but I wanted to, right? And you can't say, but what do you mean what you wanted to? You can't have this kind of rational, logical, very intellectual discussion with a four-year-old. He's just not capable. This is why time and time again we've said that children at that age are just playing, right? This one, they're not able to control their actions, control what they like and dislike through their intellect the way parents do. If it's a nine-year-old, okay, who's able to understand, then this nine-year-old will explain to him the consequences of things. Like, now that this has happened, okay, you were not supposed to do it, but look at the carpet yourself. It's very dirty, it's very muddy, and guess what? We'll have to clean up now, and we'll have to do it together. A child understands the consequences of their actions. They say, yeah, you're right, this doesn't look very nice anymore, the carpet is dirty, okay, I'll have to clean it. And together you bear the consequences, and you clean up the carpet, basically. Child understands that my consequences my actions have a consequence to it. And in those scenarios, you don't need to be angry at all, okay? You just say that this was not supposed to happen. And the reason why this wasn't supposed to happen is because the result is that we have a dirty carpet now, okay? So how about you go take off your shoes right now, okay? Bring the vacuum cleaner, bring the sprays and the sponges and everything, and let's clear this mess that you've made. Let's just clear this mess.
All right. Thank you very much, Brother Maghdad, for that very interesting discussion, as always. If you missed it, you can always download an archive of this episode and all our previous episodes from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com, click on the Call of Islam tab, and you will find Islamic Upbringing right there. You can also email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. Until next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Brother Ali Alevian and Brother Soheil Sarani. Brother Soheil, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Ali, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me here.
So Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, dedicated this new series of the program Viewpoints in the whole month of Ramadan to the topic which is rarely discussed, we can say, in the academic fields and also Islamic fields, and that is the book Nahjul Balagha and the significance of this book as tackled by the leader of Iran on different occasions and his different speeches. So for today's discussion, we are discussing the important topic of the book Nahjul Balagha, compiled by Sharif al-Radhi, or known as Sayyid al-Radhi. He was the one who collected and selected the most important sermons, or speeches, letters, and aphorisms or wise sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in the book Nahjul Balagha. This book is considered as one of the greatest books in Islam after the Holy Quran, and unfortunately it's a pity that it's not given that much due attention even inside Islam, but there have been so many different interpretations and commentaries on this book. But Brother Ali, as the leader of Iran says, Ayatollah Khamenei, Nahjul Balagha is a help book for knowing more the religion of Islam. How we can know Islam more, or the true Islam more, through the book Nahjul Balagha?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Thank you very much for this beautiful and important question, because it could be a good question even for those who are living in the West or those who are not very familiar or acquainted with Islamic knowledges and sciences, even abroad. And I mean, by abroad, I mean outside of the Islamic countries, and namely our country, Iran. For a person, definitely for a researcher, to know about Islam, I think the best thing is to refer to the real and basic sources of that issue of research. Brother, we cannot judge Islam by what has been said or has been written by others about Islam, or those who claim to be Orientalists or others cannot be a reliable search or reliable source for us. It is famous to be said that it is good to drink water from the headwaters.
That's right.
That is
from the fountain.
From the fountain.
That's right.
So a person who wants to have a good water, a very purified and beautiful water, he needs to go to the fountain or the headwater of the to take from the real and genuine source.
The pure water.
If a person wants to know about Islam, so what is the best source to know about it? Definitely the first and the foremost source is Al-Quran, and this is true. But the second, if I have not got enough knowledge, enough ma'rifah, enough ilm about what Islam is. So what is the second? Which book should I read? There are different variety of books about, written about Islam with different intentions. But those who are real researchers, I want to tell them, if they are familiar with the art of research, as a researcher, as a scholar, as a person who wants to delve into a scientific question and issue, it requires to refer to Quran and Nahjul Balagha, the Peak of Eloquence.
That's right.
Because when Quran has been revealed to the Holy Prophet, it was supposed to be interpreted by him and his household. Mm-hmm. And actually, Nahj Balagha is a sequence or following book of Al-Quran. And also, in some sort of way, we can say that even it is a good commentary of Al-Quran. And it the importance of it is to the importance, actually equals the importance of Al-Quran. Because this is what the Holy Prophet himself told us. When he talks about thaqalain, or two great heavy things, and he says, "Inni tarakum fikum thaqalain kitabullah wa atrati," I leave among you two important, heavy, precious things. One is Al-Quran, and the other is my Ahl-Bayt.
That's right.
It means that they are the interpreters of the Quran. So if you want to know about Islam, read Nahjul Balagha.
Okay.
If you want to know about Islam, first read Quran, then read Nahjul Balagha. And Nahjul Balagha has been written or said, actually, as a collection of sayings and wisdoms and sermons and was sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And he is the first person who came to accept Islam among the Muslims. He was the first person who accepted and embraced Islam at the dawn of Islam, and then he became the leader of this religion at the dawn of Islam, right after the Holy Prophet. So
that's
whatever
right.
comes to us is from this person.
Okay, thank you very much, Brother Ali. So it shows that the sayings in the Nahjul Balagha are really practical ones.
Very true.
That's right, and comes from the practice of Imam Ali alayhi salam. I could remember there was one professor of mathematics in one of the foreign universities. He was invited to the city of Qom. I was his interpreter, the translator. His name was Dr. Munir Fasher. He said that once I was looking for a book in my library, and all of a sudden, by accident, I came to a book known as Nahjul Balagha. So I picked it. When I opened it, the first sentence and the phrases that I wrote, I said, "Who is this man? And who was this man who wrote this? This is really close to the texture of the Holy Quran. I've never seen something like that before." And he said that for me as a Christian, it was really a shock that how the wording of Imam Ali alayhi salam could be similar to the Holy Quran in terms of the eloquence and the fasaha and the balagha. That's right. Okay, Brother Soheil, let's get to...
Related to what you said, Shakib Arsalan.
Shakib Arsalan, okay.
Egyptian scholar and belletrist, when he was appointed to be given, I think, a prize for his literary works, the presenter of that conference or that meeting said that we can see only two important and great literary works in the history. One is for Shakib Arsalan and the other is for Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. He got angry and stood up and said, "Are you comparing me to Ali alayhi salam, Ali ibn Abi Talib? Who am I to be compared to Ali in my literature? Though my nasr or my writings in comparison to Ali is nothing."
Okay.
This is just to complement what you have said.
That's right. And we should take care that Ali was not a belletrist. He was an imam, okay? He was a successor to Prophet Muhammad. His verse has divine rootings, and we can say roots. The case sometimes what is misunderstood in the world of Islam among the blatterists and the men of literature is that they are comparing the text of the Holy Quran, Saifat al-Sajjadi and Nahjul Balagha, to a mere text of adabiyat or literature. But that was not literature, okay? That was a part of the literature of Islam. But the case is that the text and the context of this book is very much different from the stories, novels, short novels or something like that, or the poetry.
That's a very important point, actually.
Yes. Brother Soheil, what's your take on that?
Yes, brother, that's a very good point that you mentioned about Imam Ali alayhi salam being leader
and not just bilaterals. Oftentimes, like, you know, people tend to limit certain things to a certain area. Like, for example, Najwal Balagha, if you look at that book from just from the literature point of view, then it's limiting to it. But very rightly, Rehber mentions in one of his speeches that it's not a work of a wise man, for example, who is, you know, out of his rationality and, you know, the high level of cognition, he is writing something or he is mentioning which is not connected with the reality. Mm-hmm. Or it's not the work of a spiritual man or Arif, for example. So the wayfarer, you would say.
That's right.
It's not the work of that spiritual being who is, you know, projecting his inner thoughts and his inner feelings into some sermons and, you know, speeches.
That's right.
It's not that. It's actually connected and very well touched with the reality, because he was the leader at that time, and he touched upon all the dimensions of humanities. He touched upon the various aspects that human life faces. Okay, there is about war in Najwal Balagha. There is about peace in Najwal Balagha. There is about politics. There is about economy. There is about taqwa. There is about you know, worshiping God. So there is about tawheed. There is about belief system.
That's right.
So it's a complete code of conduct. It's a very you know, if you look at the book in that particular angle, then how Rehber mentions is, when you read Najwal Balagha and when you comprehend that, in a process you get to know Imam Ali alayhi salam and you get to know Islam.
That's all right.
Both at the same time, because, you know, it's a complete Islam Shanasi.
Yes. Islamic studies.
Yeah.
Islamology.
And then you know about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam as well, because Imam Ali alayhi salam lived his life based on Quran and Najwal Balagha himself.
This is very important. The important point that Brother Sohail says. You know, when we get to the interpretation of the religion of Islam and the character of the Prophet Muhammad and Holy Quran, there are so many different sayings regarding this. And every person from his own aspect and angle has talked about Prophet Muhammad and the reality of Islam. But when you get to the text of Najwal Balagha and through the character of Imam Ali alayhi salam and the very personality of his sayings, you want to know Islam, I think you have an authentic source now, because Ali was the first Muslim. He was among the most important authentic Sahaba of Prophet Muhammad. He was the successor of Prophet Muhammad. So many divine secrets have been blown into his spirit by Prophet Muhammad. So when you want to know Islam and the true Islam, I think some people maybe condemn us of fanaticism, that you are a fanatic and we can say fan of the religion of Islam because of Muhammad and because of the very nature of Islam. But when you get to Najwal Balagha and the very character of Imam Ali alayhi salam, then you can find how practical could a person be and be obedient to his master, that is Allah, and then the Prophet of Allah, that is Prophet Muhammad.
Exactly.
This is unfortunately what is missed in today's world. You know, when we want to refer into the interpretation of Islam, we start from the various scholars that live in our contemporary time.
You know, in one of the tradition, I would paraphrase that Imam Ali alayhi salam says that know the truth and you will know the people of truth.
Mm-hmm. People of truth.
So
that's right.
There's the right methodology of knowing, you know, looking at Islam, that you need to know the truth, and then you will know who were on truth and who were those personalities. So you don't learn the things through the personality, but you know the personality through the, you know, the substance. And very rightly mentioned, you know, in one of the tradition, we also see that, and again I'm paraphrasing, where our Holy Infallible Alayhi Salam says, if you present our sayings and our teachings to people as they are, then the beauty of them would make people follow us. You know, so that's very obvious. Like when you present the content to the world, and they'll definitely, you know, Rehber also mentions in one of his speeches that those who are, you know, those who are criticizing Islam or those who have some issue, and then they are pinpointing each and everything about Islam.
That's all right.
Before doing that, I would like to tell them And he clearly mentioned that, you know, go and tell my words to them. Go and say them, tell this to them, those who are like, you know, in the Reformation, you know, quote unquote, like they call
That's
it,
right.
call themselves as reformative camp or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Go between them and, you know, tell them that, you know, before doing this criticism, read once this book, Najul Balagha, and then see if you can criticize.
Okay, thank you very much, Brother Sohail and Brother Ali Alavian for
your
presence in the program. Viewpoints, which was on the topic Najul Balagha, as discussed by the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Dear listeners, visit our website at parstudio.com/Iran Call of Islam Radio, also our YouTube channel, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
يا نور الهلال أقبل تعال فالشوق طال والقلب سما نحو السماء مترنما لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان
The subcontinent.
Hi everyone, this is Don and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations and the region of South Asia as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about India's nascent alliance called Quad with Japan and Australia, as well as the United States, and its impact on geopolitics of the Indo-Pacific region. And we shall also take a look at the recent rise of Maoist attacks in India and the prospects of peace for the decades-old insurgency.
Some call it the Asian NATO, but many believe this is a misnomer. The Quad is a combination of a couple of trilateral ties with India or US at the center that is now shaped into a four-way partnership. The quadrilateral security dialogues bringing together United States, Japan, Australia, and India, but such an alliance may provoke a spiraling set of reactions from other Asian players, such as China and Russia.
Consequently, this week, the OECD...
Leaders of the four-member Quad grouping, or the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, held their first summit mid-March 2021, but the strategic partnership, presumably against China, was in the making since the beginning of the century. The Quad was first established by then-President George W. Bush following the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami and, after a long hiatus, was reconvened by Donald Trump in 2017. Its advertised aim was fostering a free, open, and inclusive Indo-Pacific region, but the implicit goal was to address concerns about Beijing's growing economic influence, military prowess, and technological heft. Although this year's virtual meeting focused on non-military initiatives and China was never mentioned in any statements or proceedings, the Quad has the potential to further divide the already complex geopolitical arrangement of Asia. Its extension, or the Quad Plus, including France, Canada, and perhaps the United Kingdom or New Zealand, may prompt a counter-axis with Russia or Pakistan in tandem with China.
India and three other Quad countries have recently kicked off a major